Welcome to the Government Contracts Legal Roundup, a podcast focusing on important developments facing government contractors and grant recipients. This podcast is put on by the Jenner and Block Government Contracts Practice Group. I'm David Robbins, and I co-chair that group, and it's still my pleasure to host this podcast. I guess we'll start with the end of the contractor COVID-19 vaccine mandate. On May 9th, the president issued an executive order revoking his prior executive orders requiring vaccination of federal employees and requiring federal contractors to follow the COVID-19 safety protocols issued by the Safer Federal Workforce Task Force, which is a mouthful, but you know what I mean, including what became known as the contractor vaccine mandate. As of May 12th of this year, the new executive order covers ancient history at this point, recounting the circumstances during which the two prior executive orders were issued, the advent of the Delta variant and the rise in cases and hospitalizations of COVID-19, it states that the two prior executive orders, quote, were necessary to protect the health and safety of critical workforces serving the American people and to advance the efficiency of government services during the COVID-19 pandemic. It cites broad success in the vaccine program and critical investments in testing and therapeutics, and concludes that considering this progress, and based on the latest guidance from our public health experts, we no longer need a government-wide vaccination requirement for federal employees or federally specified safety protocols for federal contractors, conveniently ignoring that most courts have said they couldn't enforce them anyway. So, after much uncertainty, some litigation, and contractor COVID-19 vaccine mandate has met its end in a relatively quiet fashion. Perhaps more exciting, or perhaps more burdensome, I can't tell which. On May 10th, the National Institute of Standards and Technology, or NIST, issued a third draft revision to the Foundational Cybersecurity Standard, Special Publication 800-171, protecting controlled unclassified information in non-federal systems and organizations. Draft Revision 3 follows a pre-draft call for comments issued in July of last year and a public comment period. Explaining the need for an update, NIST noted that the initial publication was published in June 2015, with only minor updates in December of 2016 and February of 2020. Since then, there have been significant changes in the cybersecurity threats, vulnerabilities, capabilities, technologies, and resources that impact the protection of controlled unclassified information. The draft publication includes updates to align SB 800-171 with SB 850-REV-5, and SB 853B, moderate control baseline. That will make sense to those of you who follow cyber and will be alphabet soup to those of you who don't. Call us if you have any questions, though we'll untangle it for you. Significantly, the draft revision updates the controls by increasing the specificity of security requirements to remove ambiguity, improve the effectiveness of implementation, and clarify the scope of assessments. The draft revision also removes outdated and redundant controls and withdraws certain requirements that were incorporated into others. The total number of requirements, though, remains the same at 110. NIST will host a webinar on June 6th to provide an overview of the changes, and the public comment period is open through July 14th. Now, what does this mean? For most government contractors, implementing the NIST SB 800-171 controls represents an important compliance area, with increasing implications ranging from the allegations of False Claims Act violations for noncompliance to eligibility to compete in procurements at the CMMC rubric we've heard so much about. Contractors should scrutinize the proposed changes in this latest draft revision and ensure that their systems are prepared to comply with these updated requirements. And I'll note for you, I started my career, well, doing business school and law school at the same time, and my MBA internship with a consulting company that put me inside the National Institutes of Standards and Technology, or NIST. But then, nobody knew what NIST was. Cybersecurity comes to the fore, and everybody knows what NIST was. It's always been that building up I-270 in Gaithersburg I worked at for a number of years. It's fascinating to see the evolution. All right, a minor note, OFCCP issued in late April a new voluntary self-identification of disability form, which updated the preferred language for disabilities and included additional examples of disabilities. This is the language from OFCCP, not mine. But this is a mandatory form. The deadline for contractor adoption of this new form is July 25th, 2023. Make sure your HR department has this on hand. They're going to need it. All right, let's get into some decisions. We've got a Federal Circuit one of interest that reconsiders CDA jurisdiction. This is EEC International Constructor versus Army, argued in May, and there are recordings available online. If anybody wants the link, let us know. We'll send them along. Federal Circuit's panel's questions during oral argument suggest the court is actively reconsidering whether the notorious some certain rule qualifies as a jurisdictional prerequisite to litigation under the CDA. The CDA does not even mention some certain, yet the Federal Circuit has long held that a claim for monetary relief must state a sum to perfect jurisdiction for CDA litigation. During argument, the panel appeared to recognize that a recent line of Supreme Court precedent admonishes lower courts for imposing jurisdictional requirements beyond those that are clearly imposed by Congress itself. The panel included Federal Circuit judges Prost, Lynn, and Cunningham. What does this mean? Eliminating the jurisdictional requirement for a sum certain would be the Federal Circuit's second critical step, should they take it, towards correcting the jurisdictional rules applicable to CDA litigation. The first one was in 2014, when the court confirmed the CDA's six-year statute of limitations could no longer qualify as a jurisdictional rule, permitting parties to toll the statute of limitations. When it comes to thought leadership on this topic, our colleague and special counsel, Nathan Castellano, has published several articles over the years, including many arguing that, in light of the latest Supreme Court precedent, the CDA claims submission certification and timely appeal requirements do not qualify as jurisdictional rules. That means you might get hearings sooner on more, and this is something we all should be paying attention to. I know Nathan will, and we'll put out something updating you once the decision issues. We have a claim case, Mid-Atlantic Construction and Design Associates, issued earlier this month. Court of Federal Claims issued this decision denying the government's motion to dismiss for lack of subject matter jurisdiction, where the contractor challenged the DLA's refusal to issue a final decision on the CDA claim. Contractor submitted an REA and a revised REA for unabsorbed corporate overhead costs caused by changes and delays experienced while performing under the contract. However, after a certain point, DLA just refused to grant the contractor's request and refused to issue a final decision in the matter. Contractor appealed to the court. At the heart of DLA's motion to dismiss, DLA argued that the contractor failed to timely submit a duly certified claim to the contracting officer under this CDA. Interestingly, given what we just talked about, when denying the government's motion to dismiss, the judge emphasized that the Federal Circuit's decision in Sikorsky Aircraft, the United States, held that the six-year statute of limitations for contractors to file a certified claim is not, you guessed it, jurisdictional. Okay, let's move on to protest cases. In Aptum Amentum Alaska Decommissioning LLC, which is one of the longer business names I've heard of, but hey, it's the name of this protest, so we go with it, published earlier this month, GAO sustained in part a protest where the awardee's proposal failed to meet a material requirement of the solicitation. Here, the Army Corps issued a solicitation for the decommissioning of a nuclear reactor facility in Fort Greely, Alaska. GAO agreed with the protester that under the management approach factor, the awardee entirely failed to submit a key personnel retention plan, which was a solicitation requirement that GAO found to be material. The fact that the awardee had also submitted letters of commitment for key personnel, something we see a lot, of course, that was immaterial here because the requirement to submit a key personnel retention plan was distinct. When a proposal fails to meet a material requirement of the solicitation, the proposal is technically unacceptable and cannot serve as the basis for the award of a contract. So here, GAO sustained the protest and recommended that the agency either eliminate the awardee from competition or solicit and evaluate revised proposals and issue a new source selection decision. And in TechSynap Corp., the United States, yet another example of when you host a podcast and you only see names written, you have to guess at their pronunciation. We're going with that. This is a Court of Federal Claims decision published earlier this month. And while the court typically decides protests based upon the existing administrative record, occasionally discovery will be permitted if necessary to adjudicate the protest. This is one of those times. Here, the protester alleged that the awardee materially misrepresented the proposed program manager, which was a key position ever intended to perform on the contract. Following the submission of dueling declarations, the infamous dueling declarations, the court was faced with categorically conflicting statements regarding whether or not the awardee offered the job to the outgoing program manager. Protester moved to supplement the AR and to conduct limited discovery. Chief Judge Kaplan granted the motion, allowing the protester to depose three witnesses. in the context of a material misrepresentation claim where, quote, it is unlikely at best that an administrative record will ever include the evidence a court would need to determine whether a statement made in a successful proposal was false, unquote, decision reflects that given the stark divide between the assertions of the outgoing program manager and the awardee's categorical denial, depositions were, quote, appropriate to determine whether or how the apparent conflict can ever be reconciled. Supplementing the AR is worth pursuing in cases where the existing record is incomplete, and it provides evidence needed to decide a protest on the merits. A material misrepresentation claim is a prime candidate for such discovery, and also think about it whenever you have the infamous dueling declarations that are wildly different. With that, let's wrap this up. It's gone on long enough. Thank you for joining us for the Government Contracts Legal Roundup. If you have any questions or need more information about anything here, I'm David Robbins. I can be reached at 202-639-6040 or drobbins, with two Bs, drobbins@jenner.com. Thank you so much.